Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The University of Tulsa History Department presents its annual Caden Head Settle Lecture this Thursday, this year with a University of Oklahoma scholar who is seriously examining Native American communities in the years prior to the westward advance of the United States, the colonial years. Joshua Piker is an associate professor of history at the University of Oklahoma, specializing in colonial American history and Native American history. He's the author of Okfuski, a Creek Indian Town in Colonial America, which examines the Creek settlement located in pre-removal Alabama in conjunction to its British colonial neighbors. His lecture is based on a forthcoming book. The lecture is titled The Four Deaths of Acorn Whistler, Telling Stories in the Colonial American Frontier. It's a Rashomon-like storytelling of the 1752 execution of an obscure Creek chieftain for a crime he had nothing to do with. The Caden Head Settle Memorial Lecture takes place this Thursday at 6 o'clock at Gilcrease Museum. It's free and open to the public. Professor Joshua Piker is my guest today. Joshua Piker, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
In the lecture you'll be giving here on the University of Tulsa campus, you're going to tell us the story of Acorn Whistler. Now, this is a name totally forgotten to history. So why is he important?
Well, I think in the end, he's not important. He was a very, very unimportant man, but important things happened around him. He became the center of first a massacre and then a controversy about how to resolve this massacre back in 1752, and the controversy involved Creeks and Cherokees, British colonists, and British Empire officials, and watching them work through the controversy and come to terms with the massacre that he was involved in allows us to begin to understand what it meant to live in the American colonies, to be part of the British Empire, to be a Creek, to be a Cherokee. And so for those reasons, Acorn Whistler is important. As a man himself, he wasn't very important, and that's in fact why he was in the end executed as sort of someone who took responsibility for the massacre.
Give us a sense. You specialize in the history of what we now know here in Oklahoma, the five civilized tribes, especially the Creeks and the Cherokees, in colonial times. Now, I think the popular history today is that those tribes adapted pretty easily to assimilation and that there weren't really a whole lot of territorial issues or conflict between Europeans coming to then the colonies and these tribes until, say, the early 1800s at the time of leading up to removal. But it sounds like all European interactions with Native Americans, there were conflicts.
Well, there are always conflicts, right, when people from different cultures come together and try to get people from other cultures to behave as they're supposed to, you know, supposed to in quotation marks.
Right.
Your sense of the basic trajectory is pretty much accurate. The only problem is that, as you say, it tends to pick up, the conflicts tend to pick up in the early 1800s. What we see before then are not so much endemic wars, but we see lots and lots and lots of arguments and disagreements. And the reason you have these arguments and disagreements is that the Creeks, and that's the people I focus on, the Creeks, are very insistent that they should not have to adopt and adjust, and that people around them should adopt and adjust. And so the problem with the popular view of what the so-called five civilized tribes did is that it tends to assume that they are in a subordinate position to Europeans. And eventually, of course, they would be, right? And then they will have to adopt and adjust. And, you know, there's all sorts of arguments and debates about the degrees to which they can carve out their own niche in this world. But at some point, they will be living in a world dominated by Europeans. But in the time that I'm talking about, and so the massacre I mentioned is 1752, the Creeks are probably the most powerful military force south of Pennsylvania, south of New York. They're certainly the most powerful Indian nation in the southeast. And they very much knew that. And so they were insistent that others would adjust to their norms and their agendas would dominate affairs. And that's one of the issues that's actually being sort of negotiated in the Acorn-Whistler crisis is exactly how will people resolve a crisis. Will they resolve it using Indian norms, using European norms, using colonial norms? And so this is one of the issues that's very much in play at the time.
If the Creeks were the most powerful military force, did you see the first colonists in the Carolinas basically trying to adapt to Creek norms and rules?
Well, that's a great question. The colonists are not necessarily happy that the Creeks are this powerful, and the colonists are always aware that there is this power over the seas, right? There is the British Empire, which can, if it so desires, deliver a great deal of force to the southeast. The problem is that it never does desire to do this until the late 1750s and early 1760s. And so the colonists are constantly aware that they have to take into account what the Creeks think, both because the Creeks are powerful and also, of course, because in the colonial period, the Spanish control what's now Florida, and the French control Louisiana, part of Mississippi, and the lower Mississippi Valley. And the Spanish and French and the British don't get along with each other. And so if the Creeks decide to side with the Spanish or with the French, the British have a very active problems on their hands. So, yeah, the British are constantly adjusting to what the Creeks are desiring, at the same time that the British are also trying to get the Creeks to recognize, sort of inherent European superiority, as long as we understand inherent superiority in quotes there.
Which really helps us understand Indian removal in the early 1800s, because now Spain no longer controls Florida, the French no longer control Louisiana. There's no balance of power there.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, that's with native peoples, both east and west, you really see the situation start to spin out of control from their perspective when they no longer have another European nation to appeal to. And there are ways they can play with that. There are temporary fixes you can make. So, for example, the Creeks would not just play the British off the French off the Spanish, but they would play Georgia off South Carolina, two British colonies that didn't always get along with each other. The Creeks could find a way to make that work for them. But once the United States is on the scene, once the British leave the area after the War of 1812, it becomes very, very difficult for Native nations to have any real say in shaping the broader contours of their world. So you're exactly right.
So take us back to the 1750s when this massacre occurred. One of the things I understand it was nearly on the streets of downtown Charleston.
Yes, exactly right. The massacre happened on April Fool's Day, 1752. And a group of Creeks who were in Charleston visiting the governor of South Carolina attacked and killed, attacked a party of Cherokees who were also visiting the governor. There were 12 Cherokees, 26 Creeks, 5 of the Cherokees were killed. And this happened within sight of the buildings in Charleston. The Cherokees had just left the city. It happened within earshot of the governor's mansion. And, as you can imagine, this became an enormous problem for the British and for the Creeks. The Cherokees were very upset. The British were appalled that this had happened. And the people in charge of both the Creek Nation and the British Empire had to find some way to deal with this problem. And so that's sort of the core incident that will be at the center of the talk that I'm going to give at the Gilcrease on Thursday, and also the incident that's at the center of the book that I'm working on, that I've just about finished.
Yeah, so it wasn't a massacre between European arrivals and Native American tribes. It was between two Native American tribes.
That's right.
What were the issues? I assume having something to do with land, but what caused the conflict? Were they historic enemies?
Yeah, in 1752, certain Creeks and certain Cherokees had been at war since the late 17-teens. And there had been on-again, off-again peace and on-again, off-again war. But a new war had sort of sprouted up in 1749 when a series of Creek attacks devastated a large chunk of what was then Lower Cherokee country. And this attack is, in a sense, a spillover from that. These are, in the attack, it's Lower Creeks, the people who are most responsible for the new war, attacking lower Cherokees, the people who were most victimized by the new war. And so in that sense, the attack wasn't a surprise at all. What was surprising, though, is that the Creeks and the Cherokees had met in Charleston. They had essentially gone through a diplomatic ceremony that had made them essentially brothers of each other, and both peoples had promised the governor that they would not attack each other, and in fact that once each party got home, they would extend the peace that they had reached between these two small parties to the nations at large. And so the attack, if seen within the larger war, was not a surprise. Creeks were killing Cherokees, Cherokees were killing Creeks. But the massacre should not have happened where it did, involving the people it did. And all involved realized immediately that they had a crisis on their hands, that this just should not have happened.
Now, you mentioned your title for the lecture is The Four Deaths of Acorn Whistler.
Yes.
Why the multiple deaths?
Well, the talk in the book center to some extent not on the massacre itself, because everyone pretty much agreed what happened. But my research and my writing and what I'll talk about on Thursday are focused on the stories that were told about why Acorn Whistler should take the fall for this event. Everyone involved knew from the very beginning that he was not guilty, but he was eventually executed, about 5 months later, for the, to take responsibility for the massacre. And my research focuses on four stories that were told about why Acorn Whistler had to die. There are two different Creek stories, a story told by American colonists and a story told by the British governor of South Carolina. And in each of these stories, Acorn Whistler dies a slightly different reason. He dies a slightly different death in that sense. And so there's sort of a Rashomon-like quality to this. It's a little bit like Rashomon meets Last of the Mohicans with a little bit of Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
So who was Acorn Whistler? Was he a Creek chief or what exactly?
It depends on who you believe. He was very clearly a man of not much importance, but he was not completely insignificant. He was a upper Creek, the people who lived in then what's now western Alabama. He was from a very small town, but he was probably the head warrior of that town. He was a man who had a history of drinking too much, of being very, very violent. He was someone who was not particularly popular, and he was in Charleston when the attack happened, and he had served as the spokesman for some of the attackers. And so he became a very convenient fall guy, in a sense. But everyone involved had to find some way to come to terms with the fact that he very clearly wasn't guilty.
And he wasn't among the group that committed the killings.
No, he wasn't. He wasn't even with them at the time. He was, as far as I can tell, drunk on the streets of Charleston.
So he becomes the scapegoat. What are the various reasons involved?
That's another good question.
Why would the Creek want rid of him, for example?
Well, the problem he had in terms of his own people was that he had never given anyone important a very good reason to care about him, but he had given a number of very important people a number of very powerful reasons not to like him very much. And so his family and community were not happy that he was executed. They were not at all happy. They knew he wasn't guilty, but they also recognized that he was essentially someone that they could throw under the bus to solve their problems. And they recognized that they had to find some way to mollify the Cherokees and to mollify the British. And so they were willing to let him go, essentially. There were other Creeks. Of the two Creek stories, one is told by his family and community. Another was told by the man in Lower Creek Country in what's now western Georgia, who was trying to unify the Creek Nation, trying to make the Creeks into a coherent, modern nation. And for this man, his name was Malachi, he had to find some way, again, to make sure the British would not cut off trade and would not end their relationship with the Creeks. Because as powerful as the Creeks were, they still needed access to European goods and European services. And with the South Carolina governor desperately unhappy about this massacre, Malachi realized that he had to find a scapegoat. And he couldn't punish the people who had actually committed the massacre because they were his friends and his kinsmen. So he essentially chose Acorn Whistler as the person to take the fall.
And really, when you think about that, and this is certainly in literature, but I think in the history of that time, this was not altogether an unusual event that somebody out of favor becomes the scapegoat. I mean, it's still used that way in political scandals to this day.
Sure.
So why wouldn't we think it would involve life or death issues, say, 200-300 years ago?
That's exactly right. And they had to come to some sort of agreement. And once they reached agreement, you know, they could have relatively smooth sailing. But sure, I mean, they're people, we're people, and there are agendas, and there are hidden motivations, and there is anger, and there is fear, and you look for an easy way out. And, you know, there's also more positive things. You're working towards something if you're Malachi, right? If I'm Malachi, I'm working towards finding a way to unify the Creek Nation. If I'm going to do that, I can't anger my family and my kinsmen by executing the people involved. And I can't afford to truly lose contact with the British by ignoring their request that someone take the fall for this. Well, so who should I pick? Well, Acorn Whistler, right? No one likes him very much. He's from a very insignificant town. He was present. He had a history of being violent. In fact, he had a history of being violent towards the Cherokees. He was, in a sense, the perfect fall guy.
This guy's a pain, so let's get rid of him.
Yeah, essentially.
It's all two problems.
Yeah, no one really, as far as I can tell, no one really liked him very much. But having said that, it's worth saying one thing. He doesn't appear in the records very often. He's, you know, that's one sign that he's not a particularly, I think at the end, an important person in Creek country or in the Creek's relations with the British. But because he doesn't appear in the records very much, there is this danger, right, that there may be a great deal more about him that I don't know. Right. In fact, there certainly is a great deal more about him that I don't know, but there may be something really significant that I don't know. And this is one of the really fun things about doing early American history and early American Indian history is there's always something more out there to learn. We don't even know this man's name. All we have is a nickname, Acorn Whistler. And so it's possible that the image that I'm presenting of him doesn't match the reality. I think it does. It matches all the evidence I have. But it's worth saying that it's whenever you get far enough back in the past, we take the pieces of evidence that we have and we line them up in the best way we can, and we hope that we're right. And this is the story, essentially, that I'm telling about these stories. There's certainly more to learn about the man.
My guest today is Joshua Piker. He's the Associate Professor of History at the University of Oklahoma, and he'll be delivering the annual Cadenhead Settle Memorial Lecture at the University of Tulsa History Department on the four deaths of Acorn Whistler, telling stories on the colonial American frontier. The lecture takes place this Thursday at 6 o'clock at Gilcrease Museum, and he joins us today by phone. Well, out of this, is there significance to the resolution to this story? Does it sort of set the stage for colonial British and American Indian relations for the next few years? Why is this important, I guess?
Right, that's a great question. Why have I spent 10 years looking at this, right? I mean, the short answer is no, it does not set the stage. And so this is not an event that changes the course of the world, that alters dramatically the ways in which the world unfolded after this. There are certain threads you can follow out in certain directions, but in the end, this event, I think, is more illustrative than a reshaping event. And in fact, that's sort of how I'm intending to use it. I'm writing this book and giving this lecture essentially as a microhistory. And the idea behind those sorts of histories is you take a particularly illustrative or particularly evocative event, one that shows us how the world works, and you develop the event, you tell the story in a way that draws people in. What I hope to do, though, is not just to sort of show how the world worked, but to present sort of a more nuanced perspective on what colonial America was. I want to use the stories told about Acorn Whistler in the end to change the way we think about what it meant to live in the American colonies in the late imperial period. So, you know, we're talking 1752, a generation before the American Revolution. These colonies are very well established. The British Empire is about to become the leading empire in the world. The Creeks and Cherokees have, you know, dealt with the early period of colonization. They are themselves very well established on the colonial landscape. And so what does it mean? What does this world look like when you put the pieces into motion? And the Acorn Whistler story allows me to do that, essentially. It allows me to show all of these people interacting on a regular basis, and it allows me to talk about the implications of those interactions.
And give us a sense of how these interactions were taking place by around 1750. You mentioned that the Creek still had the most potent military force in the southern United States, but you don't hear stories of these sort of all-out massacre wars like King Philip's War up in New England, where basically colonists came in and very quickly overran, the country and the Native American tribes that were occupying that land. You don't seem to hear these same sort of stories coming out of the South until well into the 1800s, the Creek Wars and the Seminole Wars in the 1800s.
No, you're exactly right. I mean, the story, if there was a sort of an equivalent story to King Philip's War in the Southeast, it would be the Cherokee story. The Cherokees were invaded twice, very destructive invasions, 1759 to 1761 by the British Army as sort of part of the 7 Years' War, the French and Indian War, and then again by the American Army in the early years of the Revolution. And both of those invasions were enormously destructive, but they're also atypical in the Southeast. And what you see in the Southeast is a much more stable set of interactions between the large interior Indian nations, the ones we know, the Creeks, the Cherokees, the Chickasaws, the Choctaws, and the European empires surrounding them. And so these people are having to find some way to deal with each other. And that's, in fact, why I like the Acorn Whistler story. It shows us how they were dealing with each other. It shows us the many ways in which their lives were overlapping. One of the things I'm hoping to do with the sort of 4 stories told about Acorn Whistler is to use these stories to show the very intimate connections between these people. So there are 4 stories. But the storytellers are not just, I'm going to get up and tell a story, but they're constantly speaking to each other. They're trying to persuade each other. They're modifying their stories as they're going on. And this process of adjusting your stories and as other people are telling stories back to you is, I think, very indicative of what it was like to live in the Southeast in the late colonial period, whether you were an Indian, a European, a colonist, or a British official. This was the reality. You had to deal with all of these different people. You had to tell stories with all of these different audiences in mind, and you had to account for other storytellers who had very different perspectives and very different agendas, and you couldn't wipe them off the map. You couldn't hope to get rid of them. That would come later. But for the people I'm talking about in the 1750s, these people are in a sense very powerful. The Creeks are powerful. I've said that. Malachi is powerful. I've said that. The empire was powerful. But none of these people could envision a world really without the other. And so they had to find a way to deal with each other. And these stories and the ways the stories were told and the agendas that people are working towards are, I think, finally the final payoff of the Acorn Whistler event of this book is that this is what the world looked like. It's a set of stories. It's a set of storytellers. It's not people giving orders. It's not people riding across battlefields. This was colonial life.
Yeah, and coming to accommodations, albeit with really bad outcome for Acorn Whistler. But is it just possible that this is a difference between New England, where there was great competition for the land, in the Southeast, where you have a lot bigger areas and fewer colonists, at least at this particular point, that the competition for land was not so keen in this particular place?
Well, that is true. And another thing to keep in mind is that it sounds obvious, but recognize that you're talking about King Philip's War in the 1600s, and King Philip's War is 1675, 76,
right. Yeah.
And I'm talking about the 1750s, 1760s, and that's worth saying because the natives in New England were confronted almost immediately by large-scale colonies with all the things those things brought. With the wars, the trade, the disease, the exploitation, the missionization, all of that. And all that happens very quickly. It's an accelerated process in the North. It happens much more slowly in the South. It's not just that the colonies aren't as big to begin with, but there's an initial period of contact in the South that we don't actually know much about, and certainly isn't very front and center in the popular imagination. But as, you know, as Plymouth is settled in 1620, as Massachusetts Bay is settled in 1630, there are explorers in the southeast. There are little forts. There is a Spanish mission system in Florida. And all these things are subtly changing the world in the southeast. And so when South Carolina is founded in 1670, for example, the South is already, in a sense, adjusted to European colonization. And there will be some other fairly major adjustments happening in the next 40 or 50 years after that. But the Indian nations in the Southeast, especially the big interior nations, have a chance to adjust to the Europeans before large-scale colonization happens. And that gives them an advantage over, you know, King Philip's people in the North. Those people had to adjust on the fly. The Creeks and Cherokees had 100 years of, you know, experimentation, death, destruction, failure, and success prior to South Carolina, prior to Georgia. And that gives them, you know, they gave them a certain safety net when dealing with these, you know, with the slave plantations of South Carolina or the frontiersmen of Georgia.
But, of course, in the end, it doesn't really change anything.
Right.
From the Native American perspective.
This is one of the things, right, is that in the colonial period, you cannot write about or think about these histories without recognizing that in the end, certain people are going to win and certain people are going to lose. But what I like about the 1750s, what I like about the sort of history I'm trying to do here, is that no one at the time knew that, right? And picking winners and losers in the 1750s is much, much harder. In fact, one of the things I'm going to say in my talk on Thursday is that, you know, we know that winners write the histories, but what do we do with histories where no one wins? No one really wins the Acorn Whistler event, right? Acorn Whistler loses, that's very clear, but none of the storytellers really get what they want. Well, what do we do with that history, right? That's a very interesting sort of history, and in some ways it's a much more typical history of the American colonial period than sort of picking a winner and riding that winning horse to the revolution and to the emergence of the United States. That's not how history was lived for most of these people. We know that that's the answer, but they didn't.
There's no inevitability in this.
No, and not just that there's, I mean, it's a really interesting problem, right? Because these, we know the large picture, but the ways in which people live their lives is not something, I think, that the large picture actually helps us grasp in any meaningful sense. And so if we want to understand the lived experience of colonization or the lived experience of being a Native American in this period, or even the lived experience of being an imperial official, we have to sort of almost forget what we know. Not entirely, because, you know, the story, if I finish this Acorn Whistler story, I say, and the Creeks were the most powerful thing, and they were just going to, you know, be all that in a bag of chips for the next 100 years. Well, you know, that's ridiculous, right? We know that's not going to happen. But I have to acknowledge, as I'm writing this, the sort of the ambiguity and possibility that these people were intimately familiar with.
All right. Well, I hope a lot of people come out to the lecture this Thursday at Gilchrist Museum, the Cadenhead Settle Memorial Lecture. Josh Piker, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was a real pleasure.
Joshua Piker is an associate professor of history at the University of Oklahoma, and he'll deliver the annual Cadenhead Settle Memorial Lecture Thursday evening at 6 o'clock at Gilchrist Museum. The lecture is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. If you miss one of our recent shows, you can listen online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just look for Studio Tulsa on the front page and click on your favorite show. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.